Writing an entire book is hard, but writing a specific scene is often even more difficult.
We're not going to tell you how to do either, but we are going to show you some fun examples of scenes we love.
We're probably not going to do that either. I think we might just ramble, lose our way a couple of times, and circle around back to whatever it was we thought today was going to be about.
Because that is what we promise you here at the Book Report Podcast. Complete chaos?
I don't know, but you can send your check or money order to my PayPal. Thanks.
This is the Book Report.
How can I pour you a drink? I'm nowhere near you.
Well, there's probably some type of Postmates type thing where you can order me a drink and have it delivered.
Can you deliver cocktails and stuff in your state?
Probably not. I highly doubt it.
We just passed it hasn't been signed yet, but a law passed in the House and Senate chamber to allow cocktails to go in Oklahoma now.
Okay. I mean, there's some, like Savannah allows you to have an open container as long as you're in the city limits.
Oh, nice. Nice.
So there are places that could be considered the promised land.
Yes, those places do apparently exist. Yeah. Guess what I'm doing right now?
You're on podcast, so talking.
Guess what else I'm doing right now?
This is a child-friendly show, and I don't think we can talk about that.
No. Because of your episode idea, I have found a PDF of a book online that I didn't have digitally, and I am searching for a very specific scene in it, but it's a book I have not read in more than a decade. So.
Okay. What's the book?
It's And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie.
Okay. I didn't know you'd ever read any Agatha Christie.
What? I've read And Then There Were None. I've read, crap, what's that one on the train?
Yeah, that was a real short list there, bud.
I don't remember the Orient titles. Express. Yes. And something else.
Wow. This is exhaustive. I'll tell you what.
I know. I'm very bad at remembering. I got in a thing where I read a lot of her stuff when I was younger, and now I've forgotten all the titles of the books.
Fair enough. Is this why you always wore a name tag every day?
Yes, probably.
In college? So that you didn't forget your name? Is that what that was about?
That was it. That's all I...
Okay.
Okay, now I just want a list of all her books now, people. Why is this so hard?
Oh, boy. I don't know. She wrote a lot. It's kind of a long list.
No, not Agatha Arch is Afraid of Everything. What the hell is that? List of books by Agatha Young. What?
Maybe. I don't know. That's weird. Agatha Christie's like the number one person.
Okay. I don't know what happened, but it decided to look up Agatha Young instead of Agatha Christie.
Okay. No, yeah, your internet's just terrible. Mine pulled it up in the first go around.
I've read The Murder on the Orient Express, The Death on the Nile, The ABC Murders. And then there were none.
I have not read any of her stuff. Would you recommend it?
Really? Oh, yeah. At least And Then There Were None. That one's almost a needed read. Oh, I've read, is that it? The Mousetrap? Yeah.
Did you ever see that movie? Back in the day?
I don't think so.
I think it's called Mouse Hunters or Mouse...
Oh, where they destroy the house trying to kill that dog?
Yeah,
that's a good movie.
That was one of my favorites as a kid. Oh, shoot. That was directed by Gore Verbinski. Okay.
That's Gore Verbinski? Should I know that?
He's the guy. Yeah, he did the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Man, yeah, that would have been like Paul W.
Nathan Lane, Christopher Walken. You would think.
Mm-hmm.
Vicky Lewis.
At least the later ones.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's very inside baseball. Yeah. How are you doing?
Oh, you know, been better.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I don't know, your voice was very, like, checking in with me when you asked that question, so I felt like I should just return the favor by being depressed.
Oh, I mean, you don't have to be depressed if someone checks in with
you. Things are good. My wife loved the gift you got her for her birthday.
Oh, yay.
Yeah.
She wanted to sick some of that evil on me, and I was like, the whole point of giving her that was that I could get to see what it looks like without ever having to drink glittered cocktails.
Yeah, that's fair. But other than that, not a lot. I made a carrot cake today. It took me literal hours. It was very involved.
Nice. Mm. I am working on a second set of wooden rings, finally.
Okay.
Because and I started that process, and so my hands are almost completely covered in patches of super glue because I refuse to wear gloves.
Okay.
Yeah, very dumb.
Go you, man. Go you. This is a pretty neat lobby you got there.
It's pretty cool. I don't think I'm going to be able to find this specific passage. It's so small.
That's all right. You sound very distracted.
I am. I'm sorry. I'm scrolling through this endless PDF trying to find this stupid thing, and it's not.
Mm-hmm. It's not I can tell in your lack of witty repartee. So,
sorry. I will stop trying. So you came up with the concept of this episode. Why don't you take it away?
So the concept, since we haven't introduced it yet for anyone listening.
I mean, we may have made an intro at this point that we put
back. Yeah, who knows? I don't know what we're doing.
Let's pretend we haven't and just go with it.
Let's pretend we have and screw it up. Okay, so the concept is how we think certain scenes should be written. So how should a successful action scene be written? How should a love scene be written? How should a, you know, dialogue be written or something like that? And the reason that I was thinking about that is because I know when I'm reading a book, a lot of times action scenes are just a slog to read through. And they should be the most exciting part of a book, but it's just like reading a technical manual on how to swing a sword or how to aim a gun. And it's not fun to read. And it should be. It should be really harrowing. It should keep me on the edge of my seat. But a lot of people just aren't able to do it successfully. And so I kind of just wanted this episode to pick your brain, to be honest. I was curious what your thoughts were on that and thought I could offer up a few of my own. So that's where that idea came from.
Okay.
Also, you asked how I'm doing. I've started bow making.
Bow making?
That's my hobby. Yeah, like bow and arrow making.
That's awesome. I tried to do that when I was like in middle school and ended up using way too dry of wood and breaking it all over my face like that kid in My Side of the Mountain.
Yeah, I'll do it. No, I've got a whole bunch of, like, tools. My draw knife should get here soon. I did most of the profiling without it, and then it got difficult, so I went ahead and ordered a draw knife.
That is amazing. So we're going to go bow hunting with...
For humans. Most dangerous obviously, game.
With your fashioned bow, right?
Hell yeah. Let's do it.
I'm on board.
Let's do it. All right, cool.
Well, yeah, when you told me the concept for the episode, your wife just sent me the bow that you're talking about. She sent me a picture of it. She can apparently hear you from the other room.
Oh,
that's super cool.
It's very unfinished. Very, very unfinished.
I'm going to post that to our Instagram or something because that's really cool looking.
Yeah. I just started Saturday, so it's very much not.
I was about to be like, why is your wife texting me while recording? But she's sending me pictures of what you're talking about.
She just loves you. She wants
she's
to be near
cool.
you. Yeah.
Well, y'all should move back to the Midwest or I'll move over there. That makes more sense.
Sounds like a plan. It makes more sense for you to move?
Yeah, I hate it here.
You've been saying that for a decade.
I've been saying that forever.
At least.
It's just not... I don't have options.
Which means you actually like it. You like Oklahoma City.
I just hate change, and you know that.
I think you like Oklahoma City. It's a cool city.
I like Oklahoma City itself. I don't like the rest of the state.
Well, as a traditional urbanite, you don't ever have to leave.
That's true.
You don't have to leave the city. It's the way to go.
Well, anyways, when you told me the concept, I immediately remembered reading a book I recommended on this episode called On Writing. Which we've both talked about multiple versions of the book On Writing, but mine was On Writing and World Building. And I'm blanking on the author, and I'm not in my office where I can just pull the book up, so we'll just pretend it doesn't have an author.
You said you were going to get me that for Christmas, and you didn't.
I was going to. I'm waiting for the second one to come out, because there's two of them together. Yeah. Timothy Hickson, On Writing and World Building, Volume 1. And he has a lot to say about constructing a scene, and his YouTube videos where he breaks down these things are amazing, and I highly recommend them. But so I pulled up, I actually have notes I've taken while watching his YouTube videos, reading his books, that I keep in my, like, writing folder. And it was specifically about, I can't find the one on dialogue now, but the one I found is specifically about, action scenes. And then I also went and found, specific, like, scenes and beautiful things that I, like, in books that I had on my Kindle, because it was the easiest to search through, because they haven't invented a search function for paperback books yet. Someone needs to make one, though. And so I have a couple of scenes of, like, an amazing fight scene and one, like, amazing character and setting introduction. But I don't really know how you want to structure this episode.
Sounds like you cheated.
Just a little bit.
This was supposed to be your thoughts.
All my thoughts. You need some thoughts, too.
I don't have any thoughts. I'm sorry. I really don't. I should, but I don't.
Like, name a, you sent, like, a list of, I'm going to scroll back in our text conversation. You sent a list of, you said, romance story, a fight scene, dialogue, and describing a setting. Do you have more of those, or do you have examples of each of those?
Probably. It was more just like, trying to get you thinking about it. Okay, so let's do describing a setting first. Okay. Let's do that first. So, obviously, there are two general ways that people go about designing their setting when they're writing. The more traditional way is very flowery and describing pretty much everything, from the weather to the sunlight to the season to the city, the sounds, all of that. The other way is to describe the setting as kind of like a side character. So they have someone walking down the street and they'll notice something, and that kind of allows you to fill in the blanks in your head. And the way that I personally think that you should write a setting is more the, it actually, I would say it kind of depends for me. So some authors are way too wordy and they need to shut up and get to the point. I think that depending on the book though, it can really add something to do that old school flowery language.
And the genre, depending on the book and the genre.
Yeah, because the old school way of doing it makes it feel a lot more flowery, a lot more poetic, and sometimes I like that.
It to some level.
Yeah.
But if it's in a story or a genre that is otherwise surface level, even if your book is deep, if it's in a genre that is more considered surface level, and you do some of those flowery, long form, fanciful descriptions of things, it sounds so dumb, and it just does not.
It does, and I think that that's one of the struggles that a lot of inexperienced writers have, is they try to do these really in-depth explanations of their setting because they want to make sure that the reader is, like, aware of the setting. But I don't think that's that necessary, because if I pick up a fantasy book and I see, like, a guy holding a sword on the cover, I kind of know what the setting is going to be. I don't need you to tell me everything that's happening necessarily.
That's fair.
But I think go for it.
I think in constructing a setting, we talked about in last season, we did a whole list on, like, how to craft things. We never talked about the actual writing of it, like, talked about how to build up a setting, but, like, in the writing of it, in the actual description, I read somewhere a quote I love that was like, you should know the whole iceberg, but just show the tip or something like that. You need to know so much more than you're telling your audience. Because if you know more, it will come across in the little bit you give. And that way you can just, if you know the whole world and you're standing in a piece of it, you can just say what you see and you don't have to explain, you know, the history of why that tree's there or why the wall looks this way. You can just describe it.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. And some of the most immersive books that I've ever read kind of do that. And I actually read this the other day, and I was curious how you read. So when you read a book, do you picture, like, just the character and everything around them is fuzzy? Do you picture, like, the street they're on and everything else is fuzzy beyond that? Or do you, like, in your head, see everything fully fleshed out?
Depends largely on the book, I would say.
Okay.
I think that, because some things, like I just finished reading the second book in the series I recommended last episode, the 100,000 Kingdoms and the Shattered mm-hmm. Kingdoms, or whatever the second book is called. And in that book, I vividly imagined everything because the point of view character was blind. And so it was only giving you very, like, I mean, a blind person's point of view of everything that was happening. So it made you think about how things would look because she can never see things and she can just hear and touch and, like, feel things. And so when you have something like that, where the description, like, it's missing a piece of the description, it forces the reader to think more broadly about the visuals of it if you're not giving you any visual clues. For the same way that if you are depriving them of the sounds of a situation, you're going to imagine how it sounds. Like but only if you're doing it pointedly. Often they tell you to, like, think about the seven senses or the five senses. I don't know why I said seven. I've just invented two new senses, you guys. they tell you when you're writing to write the five senses, but that's insane if you sat down in every scene and say, and then he smelled, like, I mean, it smelled woody. Or, I mean, think about where you are in your room right now. Unless there's a bad smell, you're not going to notice the smell. Unless it's freezing cold or too hot, you're not really going to notice the temperature. So when you're describing a room, you're describing, or a scene, you will be describing the things you're seeing and hearing, because those are the most obvious. And then only if it's important will you describe the smells and the feelings and the tastes. I don't know. But if that's all you have, if you are specifically missing one, you're going to over-describe the others, and it's going to force your reader to work more. And I thought that was a really, really cool way of immersing you instantly by just completely depriving you of all visuals.
That is a good one. So who do you think does setting writing the best, in your opinion?
I love, and again, I've said this multiple times, I think one of my favorite settings I've ever read was in RX, Tale of Electronegativity, by Robert Brockway. And I can't really explain, I should probably go through his and find a scene that works well, but everything in that book is so visceral and described so well that and so claustrophobic that despite the fact that it never gives you a 30,000 foot view of the city that you're in the whole time, you feel and you're in every single scene he gives you. And it's some of the most amazing writing because I just felt like I knew that city. And then afterwards in the book, I was like, wait a second, I couldn't draw you a map of everything that happened in that city like I could in a fantasy book usually, but I could paint you a picture of every single room they were in at any given time.
Okay.
That was a weird juxtaposition.
Cool.
How about you? Do you have a good setting person?
Yeah. So when I was asking the question about how you visualize books, normally I would say I can almost instantly tell whether I'm going to like a book or not based off of how much I can visualize as I'm reading it. If it's, like, all fuzzy, then it's probably not for me. Generally, I am a street visualizer, so I just visualize immediately what's going on around them. The one author that has always, no matter which book I'm reading, has always been able to, like, flesh out their entire world for me as I'm reading one scene, Brian Jakes. Like, hands down, in my opinion, the best at building worlds that I can see, hear, smell, all of it. Like, he does a phenomenal job. And I think that's because he was writing books for blind kids, so that helps.
No, that's 100% true. Like, he does a very good job of, like, as we talked about a couple episodes ago, like, even making you hungry when there's food going on in it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's kind of amazing. Okay, I pulled up Electronegativity and found just a one paragraph, and this is probably going to be not safe for work because it's a violent scene, but one paragraph that just, like, you can see how visceral everything in this book is. And this is just for like 5 seconds of scrolling. There's probably much, much better scenes. But chapter 14. Red scrambled over the scattered, shattered fiberboard, scraping the insides of his thighs as he went. He felt a trickle of hot blood well outward from the point of contact and began to itch its way down his leg. An obese man with a long chemical burn across his forehead was regaining his feet just as Red crowned the wall. The man's eyes went wide. His broad, tattooed jowls flapped thickly as he waddled across the room to retrieve a ridiculously oversized sword from its scabbard. Red ducked under the first swing, and his panicked yelps drew James' attention and back to the apartment that he and Zippy had just torn open. And so, like, every word, every sentence has a action verb in it, but it's all just describing this area. And that's like, he's combining both action and setting at the same time. And I don't know, it just works. It makes everything feel scarier and realer when you're reading this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty good. I like it.
If I would have, you know, had more thought about that one beforehand, I would have pulled, there's a scene in that book where it's the only scene, the only time in the book where he's actually just investigating the area he's in. And it's because he's trying to figure out how this completely manufactured area, everything's way post, everything's plastics and metals, nothing's natural, but it looks like he's in right. just a peaceful meadow with a log cabin. And so he's investigating everything to figure out what it's made of, because it's obviously all fake. And that scene obviously. Is probably a masterclass of like just describing a setting, because it goes from him like seeing the whole area and then like getting down on his hands and knees and investigating what they made the grass out of. And like, okay. So it gives you the minutia and the big picture at the same time, and it's really well done.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Okay, cool. All right, so what about action scenes? What do you need in an action scene, Joel?
I need...
What gets your motor running?
I need you to not forget about characters. I need you to let me see everything that is happening without focusing on every single detail. Like, I need you to not be a Marvel director in an action scene in a book.
Okay.
Because while you can, I've probably talked about this ad nauseum, but while in a Marvel movie, you can kind of get the sense of everything that's happening. Oftentimes, if you try to think through a scene that just happened, it doesn't even make physical sense. Like characters in multiple yeah. places at once, or they're just absent for large portions of a fight that they shouldn't be absent for. And things just don't work. But that way they can trick you with visuals and camera cuts. In a book, you can't do that. You have to show everything happening in order, A, and B, you can't describe every minute detail of a fight. It just will get tedious.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to write and focus on the important parts of the fight while at the same time, like, not... forgetting everything else. You have to generalize like big moments but you have to focus in on like the things that matter. It's really bad description. How about you? Cause I have a fight scene that I want to read, and it's from the Mistborn trilogy, because I think he does an amazing job of Brandon Sanderson does an amazing job of writing action scenes.
Okay,
and there's a specific one in there that is just golden. But what about you? Because I have actual like textbook stuff about how to write action scenes too.
Okay. So I think that a properly done action scene needs to have something clever or I would just say clever, honestly, because too many action scenes are someone who's in a jam and the only way they're going to get out is by blasting their way through or just football tackling some guy or overcoming them with force. And while that is visually stunning in a movie, it's really boring to read. Nothing is as boring to me as reading, like, he was hidden behind the counter. He was one man against 13. He had 13 bullets, and every single one had to make it count. Like, okay, great. He's just going to shoot them all and move on. What is way more interesting is, as he was hiding behind the counter, he noticed, you know, some random something or other, and he ends up blowing up the house, escapes because he's hiding in the fridge, something, something, something. Like, if it's interesting to read because it's clever, I want them to, like, MacGyver their way through the action sequence. not necessarily out of it, but through it. I want them to find something interesting to do as they're working their way through the action. Right.
They need to figure something. They need to, be clever. I know a lot of times in like creative writing classes and stuff, they'll talk to about your sentence structure should match the pacing of the scene. So like when things are getting faster, you should be using shorter, choppier sentences. And I think that's the stupidest thing in the world. Like, I understand the purpose of it. And I think you should use, like, at times that does create speed when you're reading it, but it also sounds dumb. Like, you just sound stupid if every single sentence is, he hit her, she hit back. Like, it's just,
it doesn't work.
So when, in the On Writing book, he talks about this is how you build an action scene. It's very simple structure is you start with a strong verb. You write everything as cause and effect in this order. React, pause, act, and then you highlight your goal, the actual moment of conflict, and then whatever disaster starts the process over where you have to react, and then pause, and then act. And if you follow that structure, the action scenes like make sense. You go in straight order, and you still get to frame things like you're continuing the story because you're not just fighting, you're reacting to what that person did, and you're always restating your goals in each scene. And then he talks about how you need to, as I just said, generalize moments without a shift in power or narrative importance. So in a big fight, think about in the last Dresden Files book where those fight scenes just went on forever. And there was so much detail all the time. And it was like visually stunning. There was awesome stuff going on. But at the same time, so much of it did not matter because two chapters later, some big bad would show up and undo everything that was just done.
Yeah. So yeah, there was too much of it. And I think that's one of the problems action sequences have is they're trying to build it up, 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 throw a wrench in the works, build it up, build it up, build. And it gets exhausting to read because it's not really that interesting to just read people throwing themselves at each other over and over and over again.
Yeah. So you have to generalize those moments and then focus in on those three or four times where there's a giant shift in power or even in like a sword fight between two people. Like, you generalize the moments where you're parrying each other's blows, but you focus in on when someone does something clever and, outmaneuvers the next person. That's the part you explain.
I agree.
And then you have to – I think another important part is you have to establish the weapons and, like, the magic and the movement all well before the fight. You shouldn't be teaching anybody how something works in the middle of the fight. If you're writing an action scene, I should know everything that is – or how everything works that's going to happen in it.
Right. Everything that's possible, I should know well in advance.
Yeah. Do not explain to me how a gun works in the middle of a fight. I should know what gunpowder and bullets are, you know, chapter beforehand.
Oh, wonderful. Because it ruins it.
Yeah. Well, in the example I have is Kelsier fighting the Inquisitor. Yes, you're fighting the Inquisitor the first time an Inquisitor is killed in the books. And this chapter or this fight scene takes 2.5 chapters, or like 1.5 chapters, I guess. Maybe 1.5. Yeah, sorry. It starts in one chapter. That chapter ends. Most of the fight takes place in the whole next chapter, and then the fight actually ends any other chapter. So 2 total chapters. However, not a single point does it get boring. 3 times it cuts away from the fight and cuts back to the fight and you've missed stuff, but it was cutting away and back to the parts where it would have been just them trading blows back and forth and nothing advancing. So every single time you're with them, a power dynamic or a plot element is happening. So you're getting Kelsier's thoughts in the middle of a fight, or you're getting him actually getting beaten or turning the fight on to the Inquisitor. So like all of it works so perfectly. And I have a scene that I want to read through it. It's just 3 paragraphs, but it shows the, like, it gives you a feeling of the whole thing. And again, if you haven't read these books, kind of spoiler, I'm not going to give the end of the fight, even though I just told you he wins. But But at this point, you've read most of the book. It's almost over. And you understand how all the magic system works very well. So they don't have to bother pausing at any point in the fight explaining how he's doing something, because it's been very well established. Okay. So Kelsier Flared Iron. Kelsier Flared Iron, pulling against a patch of soldiers to his right, while still pulling against a single soldier. The result was a pivot. Kelsier flew to the side, and the soldier, held as if by a tether to Kelsier's body, swung in a wide arc like a ball on a chain. The unfortunate soldier crashed into the stumbling Inquisitor, smashing them both into the bars of an empty prison cart. The soldier toppled, unconscious, to the ground. The Inquisitor bounced off the iron cage, falling to its hands and knees. A line of blood ran down the creature's face, across its eye tattoos, but it looked up, smiling. It didn't seem the least bit dizzy as it stood. So it gives you all of those moments I talked about. It's him reacting to being thrown backward to start with. All of the action verbs are near the beginning of the sentence, and they're always strong one. Flared, pulling, and pulling capitalized because it's using magic. And then in the middle of, you do get the short, choppy sentences, the result was a pivot. But at the same time, you get really long, complicated ones like the unfortunate soldier crashed into the stumbling Inquisitor, smashing both of them into the bars of an empty prison guard. And it's like, it's doing things that you shouldn't, that advise you against when you're writing action scenes. Nothing short and choppy about that, but you get the feeling of the whole thing, and you're not lost at any point, even though it's complicated stuff. Whew, I can't talk. You have to talk now. My mouth is dry.
Okay, well, weird.
I just rushed that really quickly and got really dry mouth.
It's weird. I would agree. I think Sanderson's really good at writing action sequences, which is good because 90% of his books are action sequences. And I think when you're writing an action sequence, if you really want, like, to me, honestly, if you want to find a good action sequence, you almost need to look to almost trashy fiction, like the stuff that ends up in an airport that you read on an airplane. Mm-hmm. Because it's not necessarily like, intellectually stimulating, but the books are written with action in mind. And that's what those authors are good at writing. You can pick up one of those books and read it on your flight from New York to Los Angeles and be done with it. Like, they are meant to keep you going, keep you on the edge of your seat. And the protagonists are really good at finding clever ways out of the action sequences, because the only thing that ever happens in those books is action. And so you have to have clever moments. So Dirk Pitt novels, or the Oregon Files, or the stuff by James Rollins, or by David Baldacci. I think those, to me, have some of the best action sequences in literature. One man's humble opinion.
No, I can see that. I haven't read dime store fiction in a while. I've been so weirdly focused on specific authors. I need to dive back into some of that stuff. Yeah,
it's honestly not. I know people give it a lot of hell. It's fun.
We did a whole episode about how fun they are, how good they are.
Yeah, they're so fun.
I just haven't picked up one in a while because I've been on this kick where I'm trying to find new authors that I wouldn't normally read, and that's why I'm deep into reading China Melville and N.K. Jemisin and Paul Huttman and people that I don't normally think about when I'm picking up books.
Yeah.
Books that aren't written for, a white dude in his 30s or 20s. I'm finding stuff I love that I would never have picked up otherwise. So it's fun, but I'm missing out my dime store fiction books.
All right.
What next, sir?
Okay. How do you want, you can either do let's just say a romance. How do you want that written in a book?
This one, I didn't have an immediate example come to mind. I loved the books we talked about with Hannah. Both of those really, especially the second one that we didn't super recommend. But I can now not even think. Is it The Color of Magic or something like that? Yeah, The Color of Magic or something like that. In Other Lands, that's what it was called. I don't know where The Color of Magic came from. I'm pretty sure that's a Discworld book.
It is. Yep, that's Terry Pratchett.
It's got some similar characters in them. But In Other Lands, because it really dealt with teenage concepts of love and how you grow out of that. because this guy is obsessed with this girl most of the book, and he thinks he's in love with her, and eventually he realizes that he didn't know what love was by the end, and realizes this friend, that the friendship he had with this person is closer to love than this other thing was. And I like that idea where it explores the actual concept of love. What I hate in stories, and what I'm getting to a point where I hate in the Wheel of Time books, is these like preordained, oh, they're just meant to be together, or books where they tell you these characters have chemistry but never ever show them to you. Even like the Harry Potter books, when Harry ends up with Ron's little sister, spoiler alert, and they never have chemistry at all in the entire story. And I'm just like, what are you talking? I hate that.
Yeah.
If you're going to give me a romance in a book, and I feel like most books need it, you need some kind of romance, it needs to be on its face believable. You should know before the characters know. Like, you should have a feeling that those two people are going to get together before the book outright tells you. And if not, don't put those characters together.
Yeah, I can get behind that. 100%. I think, so my take on this is the only way that I want either character, the only way I want a character falling for another character is because one of them was a badass in some situation. Either they were like really good at something, or they saved their life or something. I want the whole romance to develop because one person was just awesome. And that's it.
Okay.
I don't really need any like long buildup. I don't necessarily need there to be some long-standing friendship that slowly blossoms over the course of decades. Like, I just want someone to do something cool, be impressive, and the other person's like, "Yep, you're the one." Moving on.
All right, different approaches, but I can like that. If that would happen, like right now, I'm in the Wheel of Time, and I also want to talk about conflict in the Wheel of Time. Should have brought this up. He skips over a lot of the like hard work of developing characters in both conflict and in romance, I feel like. In conflict, he does it by he does this cheating thing where your main character will be so in the heat of battle and like in a trance, like he'll go into the force basically and just automatically fight. And he'll be talking about not what he's thinking, but the fact that his mind is blank. And the Name of the Wind and A Wise Man's Fear borrowed that concept a lot for the fighting, but he at least steps back and gives you other people's point of view of what's happening every now and then in fights. And so you at least get that he can write action scenes because your main character sees other people fight and isn't always the one in conflict. Whereas in The Wheel of Time, you never really see other people fight. It's just, oh, he went through the sword Tai Chi maneuvers while he was in his little trance and suddenly he won. And it was like, that's boring as hell. And he's doing the same thing with these love stories where this one girl who can kind of see the future is just saying, he's going to end up with one of us. And then the girl's like, oh, I wish he was ended up with me, but I don't love him anymore because I want to be a witch. And it's just like, they're just saying these things and are never once showing you that this person has any agency or actual emotions. And it drives me nuts.
See, that's what I'm saying. All of this would be so much better if in Wheel of Time, instead of doing it the way they do it, because when you're reading those books, basically every female character hates every male character, no matter what they do. You can, like, save the world, and the girl character's like, well, screw you, you stupid boy. And it's like, what? He just saved your life, like, four different ways. Why do you still hate this guy? Shut up. It would be way better if it was like, I don't know, Nynaeve walks into a room, blasts a bunch of bad guys, and a dude's like, oh shit, she's hot.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, and then move on. Like, they're married now.
And meanwhile, if a girl like expressed interest in a guy, the guy's always rejecting her. And it's like, but then he's mad that the girl he wants isn't expressing interest in him. It's like everybody in this entire universe is an incel, and it's super frustrating.
Yeah, it's dumb. Because, like, the girls in those books are sometimes literally throwing themselves at a man, and by all accounts, they are all parties involved are attractive, and then the guy's like, nah. You're like, what? Nope.
It's just, it doesn't make
not how that would work in real life.
I think one of my favorite, two of my favorite romances, like, have ever been built up in fiction, both of which are from podcasts, oddly enough, and both of which worked as, like, listening to the podcast the whole time, I was thinking, oh, those characters belong together. Like, they are cute together, or they have feelings for each other. And it was one of those, like, I was almost shipping them in my head, and I hate that term, but I was shipping them, and then later the relationship actually developed, and I was like, oh, I feel like a genius, because I was reading all these, like, foreshadowing signs. If you're going to do a long-winded romance, you have to do it like that. You have to give them scene after scene after scene where your audience can want them to end back up together. Otherwise, you have to do it like Steven said and just give them a moment where they both realize they're into each other. You can't do the whole, they're going to end up together and then never give them any chemistry. Like, it just doesn't work.
Right now I'm reading a book by Daniel Abraham, the guy who like wrote the Expanse series. And one of his characters is basically being put into an arranged marriage with another character, and neither of them really is interested in this, but he's engineering the circumstances so that you as the reader are like, oh man, I really hope that they end up together, even though that would end up screwing up like this whole other really important plot point that needs to happen. And that, I think, is a really cool way to write that, because there's a really high chance they are not going to be able to end up together, because otherwise a lot of other things are screwed. But you want them to be. So it's like, all right, I respect you, Daniel Abraham. Good job, man. Right. That is Price of Spring, part of the Long Price Quartet. Highly recommend it. It's very good. I've recommended it before.
The two podcasts I was talking about are the AM Archives and the which the AM Archives has a book which I have not read yet, but it's got a book called The Infinite Noise. And the other one is the Magnus Archives. Strangely enough, they're both something in the archives. neither of which I could highly recommend more. They are some of the most amazing immersive fiction I've read or listened to in a very long time. And it's probably just the podcast format is a little bit more immersive than us things, but the stories are specifically in the Magnus Archives, when it makes you, the listener, a character and throws things on its head once every season. And it's just amazing. And they finally wrapped up that series, I believe, but so good. And the interpersonal relationships are really interesting as well.
Okay. Cool.
Speaking of characters, I have this one. I think I meant to talk about it in the setting introduction. But I know you, I don't think you've read anything by her, because you did not like, for good reasons, you did not like the Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood.
Right.
But, and just because of its heavy-handedness. But Orcs and Crake is still one of my favorite books of all time. And its opening three paragraphs are the, I think, I can't come up with a better character or setting introduction in the opening three paragraphs of this book, because it tells you everything you could possibly want to know without explicitly stating anything. And it's just amazing writing. You know how they talk about how the book A Clockwork Orange, in its beginning, it was a cold day in May and the clock was striking 13, is just a perfect opening line? And yes, it's really good, but also, it's about to snow next month in April here in Oklahoma. So the whole cold day in May thing never made sense to me. It's often cold in May here. Right. And the clock was striking 13 also didn't put me out of place, because military time, I grew up next to an army base, clocks strike 13. Like, it's
all the time. None
of those things were super weird, but I get the concept that it's putting you out of your place. And I think this introduction does so much better. The weirdness, and yet completely understandable. Okay, I'm going to try to read this without, you know, losing my voice or going dry again.
I believe in you.
Snowman wakes before dawn. He lies unmoving, listening to the tide coming in. Wave after wave sloshing over the various barricades. Wish-wash, wish-wash, the rhythm of a heartbeat. He would so like to believe he is still asleep. On the eastern horizon there's a grayish haze, lit now by a rosy, deadly glow. Strange how that color still seems tender. The offshore towers stand out in the dark silhouette against it, rising improbably out of the pink and pale blue of the lagoon. The shrieks of the birds that nest out there, and the distant ocean grinding against the ersatz reefs of rusted car parts and jumbled bricks, and assorted rubble, sound almost like holiday traffic. Out of habit, he looks at his watch. Stainless steel case, burnished aluminum brand, still shiny, although it no longer works. He wears it now as his only talisman. A blank face is what it shows. 0 hour. It causes him a jolt of terror. It causes a jolt of terror to run through him. This absence of official time. Nobody, nowhere, knows what time it is. So you get, in three opening paragraphs, without a single line of dialogue, I mean, the next paragraph opens with dialogue, but it doesn't matter. You get a person who is utterly alone, who is in some kind of post-apocalyptic hellscape, and you get this sense of dread in three paragraphs, and that gives you everything you need to know for the rest of the book. This guy, alone, everything's gone to ruin, and he's dreading life and existence. And it's just so
interesting. Good. Yeah. Okay.
He would so like to believe he is still asleep is just such a good line. And then nobody nowhere knows what time it is. Like, it's just, I love this book. That opening is amazing. And there's a point later on where he finally starts giving like flashbacks to how things ended up this way. And the amazing visceral change from how Snowman now describes the world he's in and how he describes the world before he was Snowman and before it was ruined is like peak setting and world building and characterization even, because it's just night and day. And I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's one, that's, I think, probably my big note on character introduction or characterization in general is I have pages written on characters I want to put in stories or have put in stories, and I don't use them because they don't work. Like, characterization doesn't work in a vacuum, so you shouldn't give your characterization in a vacuum. I remember when we were sending writings back and forth well before we started this podcast, and I remember describing one of my characters by giving her a reflection in a mirror, and you told me that was really lazy and stupid. And it is, because it's describing the character in a complete background or in a complete absence.
Vacuum.
Thank you. You characters don't exist in a vacuum. They have to exist within their setting or in relation to other characters. So when you introduce them, you have to introduce them via something else. Otherwise, it's just dumb. It's just description for no reason.
Right. And no one looks in the mirror in the morning on a normal day and thinks, ah, yes, I have brown curly hair and green eyes with an aquiline nose and full lips. Time to go to work now. Mm-hmm. And no one does that. And if you do, you're weird and you should probably find a different morning routine. But that's that. On characterization, though, I think that it's really important to... So my ideas on characters have almost changed a little bit, and there's a really specific reason for that. Have you seen the TV series The Serpent yet?
No, I have not.
Okay, you should. It's very, very good. It's on Netflix. So okay. It's very, very good, but all of the main characters are... basically, they have like an internal conflict, and that's it ties the show together, because every single character, that is what makes them interesting. They're all conflicted about something, and that's really interesting to me, because the main, we'll call him antagonist, he's conflicted about his upbringing versus like his aspirations for a better life. The girl he's with is conflicted about like her religiosity versus like her desire for adventure. The main protagonist is conflicted about his career versus his desire to do the right thing. And so in most books that you read, authors try to give each character like their own specific character flaw or their own specific drive. But it has been really interesting watching a series where everyone essentially has the same issue going on. They're all conflicted about something, and that's what drives their character. And it's been really interesting to see that as like the theme for everyone, because it makes it really interesting in a weird way.
I like that. Okay.
Yeah, but I highly recommend watching that.
Well, that's something I've recently realized, is that I have to have structure in my characters, because I can sit and I can craft a really interesting, I think, to myself character, and then I stick them in the story and they're all going to sound the same if I don't start with them in the story, kind of thing. Or at least, yeah, so I had to, because I was trying to rewrite this first section of the long book I'm working on, and every time I got to a section, I couldn't tell characters apart unless I had their names in them. And I was like, why can't I do this? Why can't I keep them straight in my head as I'm freaking putting them down on the page? And I realized I was only defining them by themselves and not defining them by their relationship to each other. And then I came upon the five-man band trope, and that like finally clicked into my head how all these characters work together. Do you know what that is? The five-man band?
Uh-uh, I do not.
It's, I mean, you do. You probably don't know by that name. It's the trope of how it's the easiest way to get a group of characters together. You have a leader, you have a lancer who is like the leader's foil and usually steps up and is like the right-hand man, their biggest like conflict within the group, but they're still friends, and the person who takes over if the leader can't for whatever reason. So the leader, the lancer, the heart, and those are usually the core three, and the heart is most often a woman and usually the love interest of either the leader or the lancer. And they're the heart of the group, the one who keeps people together. So you have the leader, the lancer, and then you have the big guy and the smart guy. So somebody who is your lovable giant, or just the strong man, or a fat person, your Chewbaccas, your the yellow lion tamer from Voltron, like the big guy. And then your smart guy, your tech person in the group, your resident genius. And that together makes the default five-man band. And this comes from things like The Journey to the West and like really old stories that we just keep changing and using them again and again and again. But yeah, you can see that format, that trope all over fiction, but it's because it's a really easy way to classify things. And of course, once you get people into that position, you can then, you know, make them do whatever. But for me, at least, having them classified as I'm writing them instantly makes everybody click into place, and I know what to do with characters, and I know how to make them sound unique.
Okay. So yeah, I understand that.
Characterization. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Very nice.
All right. What haven't we covered?
Pretty much everything. We're professionals.
Describing a sitting, dialogue, fight scene, romance. Yeah, that's everything on your list. You even got characterization in there.
I did.
Huh.
I'm a professional. I do this for a living, which is why I'm starving right now.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, that's good. Well, yeah.
No, I'm sorry.
So, if this was more about, like, this wasn't, like, exactly crafting a scene. We talked just a lot about our favorite examples and that kind of stuff. But if you want to know more about crafting a scene, On Writing by Stephen King is still probably my favorite writing book. Elements of Style by Strunk and White is also pretty amazing. But this Timothy Hickson book, I'm starting to absolutely love, the On Writing World Building, not because it's got a lot of new stuff, but because every single thing he talks about, he breaks down with specific examples from very accessible modern things. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, pick one of those up. They're awesome. And any of the books we recommended today or talked about today, obviously we think are awesome.
Buy them. We get a commission off every purchase.
Absolutely.
Somehow don't
we
really
need to
understand.
Set up like an Amazon bookstore and actually get a commission for selling.
Affiliate link service. There you go.
Yeah.
It might as well. Might as well.
Gotta make that Skrilla.
What was that?
I don't even remember. I say Skrilla all the time and forget what it's referencing to.
Why?
It's some TV show. I don't understand why I do most of the
things
I do. Why?
Joel, why? Man.
I'm not in control of myself. We've known this for a while.
Yeah, the bathroom is always a mess. You gotta get that bowel situation under control, buddy.
I would like to.
Way to just roll with that one. Now everyone thinks you have irritable bowel syndrome, incontinence.
Well, if you want to send me your IBS tips, you can email us at bookreportpod@gmail.com. If you want to talk about, you know, other things, you can find us on Twitter at @Twitter @book_pod, Facebook @BookReportPodcast, and Instagram @TheBookReportPod with underscores between each word. We'd love to hear from you. I will post that picture of Steven's bow on our Instagram. And yeah.
Yay.
Yeah. I guess that's it.
Should be. It's yeah, not,
Dylan,
it is.
Dylan showed up about 10 minutes ago after saying he was just going to stay home today. So I wasn't expecting him, but I didn't stop the podcast. And then he texted me, "I'll be right back," and left. So I don't even know if he's in my house or not right now. Yeah, so
he's gone. He's never coming back.
But we should record an intro, and then I can go find out if he's in my living room.